Hi, welcome to this week's program. Remember the first time you heard about the stock market? I'm sure it got the adrenaline up for many of you, excited about picking stocks with dreams of doubling, tripling, or 10xing your money. The early days when you hadn't tasted your first loss of capital and you were completely unaware of the dangerous pitfalls of inexperienced, untrained, and overconfident investing. It's almost like a rite of passage where the market quickly hazes newbies and shows them that it's the one that's all powerful. So, for those of you who are new to investing, let me give you some tips on how you can keep from getting burned by the market. First, now the basics of investing sound really simple in theory. Buy low, sell high, that's it. How hard can that be? Well, you'll be surprised. To make money with a simple strategy, first you have to know what low and high really mean. And remember, in the stock market, when you buy, someone else is selling. And when you sell, someone else is buying. So what you may think as high as a seller of shares would probably be considered low enough for the buyer in that transaction. So are you really smarter than your anonymous counterparty? See what I mean? How different conclusions can be drawn from the same information. So because of this hard-to-pin-down relative nature of the market, it's important to study a bit before jumping in because it's really never as simple as buy low and sell high. I always say that investing is simple, but it's not easy. So before you start investing on your own, I do believe you should read up on basic accounting so you understand terms like revenue and revenue growth, operating expenses, operating margins, operating profit, earnings per share, you know, stuff that's on the company's income statement. And you need to know about the balance sheet as well, the terms like cash and total assets and total liabilities, current liabilities, book value, those kinds of terms. You also want to understand terms like working capital and cash flow, so you're in a slightly better position to truly assess a company's financial position before you jump on someone's recommendation to buy a hot stock. You also need to know about price-to-earnings ratios and so on. You have to understand how they get calculated and what their major weaknesses are. Very important when you compare a company's stock valuation relative to its fundamentals, relative to its competitors or the market as a whole. And while you're learning, it's always good to start out by using virtual money in a stock simulator. Most likely, you'll find that the market is much more complex than a few ratios can express, but learning those and testing them in a demo account can help lead you to the next level of study. Let's talk about playing penny stocks and fads. You know, at first glance, penny stocks, which literally cost less than a dollar per share, seem like a great idea to invest in. With as little as $100, you can get a lot more shares of penny stock than the popular companies like Facebook or Google, right? And you may be tempted by a sizable upside if a penny stock goes to a dollar. But remember, a penny stock is a penny stock for a reason. The market doesn't believe the company warrants a higher valuation, and the company may not offer much future gain. So what penny stocks offer in position size and potential profitability may reflect high volatility and really poor expected returns. So even if you buy a stock for 50 cents, because it's more highly volatile, you can end up losing your entire 50 cents should the company tank. And that risk is much less than a Facebook or a Google. And penny stocks are also exceptionally vulnerable to manipulation. You know, getting solid information on penny stocks can be very difficult because many reputed investment companies simply do not follow them, making penny stocks a poor choice for an investor who is still learning. So beware. Penny stock pushers would love to con you into thinking that they're the path to riches. And while that's true extremely rarely, most of the time, people have lost big on penny trades. As a matter of fact, on Facebook, now I see ads for the promise of making millions on penny stocks of companies involved with the commercialization of marijuana. You know, there's no easy riches, and most who get into this are going to lose everything. And it's been said, there's a sucker born every minute. So overall, I'd prefer you own a quality stock for a long time than try to make a quick buck on a low-quality company. We're talking about the dangers of investing, especially for first-time investors. Here's another one. Investing 100% of your capital in a specific investment is usually not a good move, even with a Google, a Microsoft, or a Facebook, because even the best companies can face issues down the road and see their shares decline dramatically. While you might have more upside if you go all in and the company does really well, you'll also have a lot more risk. Especially as a first-time investor, it's good to diversify and buy at least a handful of stocks. This way, the lessons learned along the way are less costly, but still valuable. You know, it's been said that investing or learning about investing costs money. Either you go to school and you learn it, either you hire an advisor and have a professional do it, or you do it yourself and lose quite a bit of money. And usually that third choice is the most expensive of the three. Here's another dangerous move is leveraging your money by using margin. Using margin means that you borrow money from your broker to buy more stock than you can afford. Using leverage magnifies both the gains and losses on your investment. So here's an example. Let's say you have $100 and you borrow $50, so you buy $150 worth of stock. Stock rises 10%, you make $15. $15 on $150. But that $15 is actually $15 on $100, which is a 15% return on capital. Pretty good, right? Now, if the stock declines 10%, you lose $15 or for a 15% loss, even though the stock only declined 10%. More importantly, if the stock goes up by 50%, you make a 75% rate of return. That's pretty good. But if the stock declines by 50%, you're left with $75. Now, from that $75, you got to pay back the $50 that you borrowed. That leaves you with just $25. That's a whopping 75% loss of invested capital. So as a new investor, make sure you don't get lured by the siren song of margin and its potential for higher rates of return. Now, talking about investing cash you can't afford to lose is another dangerous move. Studies have shown that cash put into the market in bulk rather than incrementally has a better overall return. But this doesn't mean that you should invest your whole nest egg at one time. Investing is a long-term business, and staying in business requires having cash on the sidelines for emergencies and opportunities. Sure, cash on the sidelines doesn't earn any returns, but having all your cash in the market is a risk that even professional investors won't take. If you don't have a lot of free cash beyond your emergency cash reserves, really, stay out of the market. Putting all your money on the line makes you emotionally vulnerable and leads to investing with what is called a behavioral bias. It's a handicap, which almost predisposes you to making bad decisions. So only invest money that you can truly afford to leave in the market for long periods of time. All right, finally, whether it's trying to guess which stock will be the next Apple, investing quickly in a hot stock tip, or going all in on a rumor of earth-shaking earnings, investing on new tips is a terrible move for first-time investors. Remember, you're competing with professional firms that not only get information the second it becomes available, but also know how to properly analyze a company's performance before it announces results. Rather than following rumors, ideal first investments are companies that you understand and have a personal experience dealing with. As good as Warren Buffett is, he always invests in what he calls his circle of competence, meaning he sticks to what he knows and what he understands, and you should do the same. So remember, when you're personally buying stocks in the market, you're competing against large mutual funds and institutional investors that not only do this full-time, but also have far more resources and in-depth information than the average person. Temper your expectations, start small, take measured risks with your money, with the money that you're prepared to lose, and then after you read up and become more adept at evaluating stocks, start making bigger investments. While it's tempting to bet the bank to try to make a quick buck, real money is made by slowly compounding your returns over several decades of disciplined investing. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. I'm going to categorize this in the how things work department. You know, I'm always incredibly curious about how businesses work and how they start. You know, recently I interviewed Lisa Schiff, an art advisor to Leonardo DiCaprio, and I, you know, was wondering how she developed an art advising business. And I've also interviewed, you know, quite a few along the way to find that out as well. Well, today I want to talk about the restaurant industry, how one gets started, what it takes, you know, how do you make it successful, especially with all the competition vying for your customer. And, you know, we know that restaurants are always popping up and they're always disappearing. So today I've invited a successful restaurateur to talk about it. He's been starting and running restaurants for, I guess, about 38 years. So let's meet him. His name is Barry Corin. Hey, Barry, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Steve. Nice to be here.
So tell us a little bit about what restaurants you've been involved with and what they've achieved.
Well, you know, I came out of an era in the 70s and 80s where restaurants were just bubbling up, especially in New York City. And those were the eras that people were really becoming more aware of food and wine. And I had a recent trip after I got married in the early 80s and went to California and went to a place called Mustard's Grill. There I experienced fresh fish on a grill, and that's where my restaurant started, with my first restaurant being Doc's Oyster Bar and Seafood Grill. That's on 89th and Broadway.
Okay.
That started in 1985 and brought grilled fish to New York. And with that came a second Doc's, and my partners and I decided to sprout out. We also created and founded Carmine's New York City, which now has two locations. And then from there, my partners and I decided that there wasn't any place on the Upper West Side to have just a sandwich without going into an old-fashioned diner. And we opened up EJ's Luncheonette. And from there, we had three locations, one of which is active still on 73rd and 3rd in Manhattan.
That's wonderful. Okay, well, I think we got a good sense of your experience. You know, Barry, this is not scientific, but it seems that the most amount of small businesses seem to be the restaurant business. You know, it seems anyone who believes they're a decent cook feels that they can run a successful restaurant. What's your take on that?
Well, you have to have the drive to do that. You have to be inspired by something in your life to do it as a vocation and to do it on a daily basis. I think there are lots of people out there that are listening that knows a fantastic recipe that they'd love to give to their favorite restaurant to try because they know it'd be a success.
Yeah.
But to make it on that is just not enough. You have to cover all bases in the restaurant business. You know, so many businesses into one. And it runs basically on emotion sometimes. An investment, if you're dealing for a return on your dollar and you're investing in the market, you make that investment and you let it sit and you follow the trends every day. Here in the restaurant business, it's run on people mostly and on a daily basis. Wait staff that represents you and your goal, and to create that every day on a constant and a consistent level is very difficult.
Very difficult. It takes a lot of hours too, I've noticed, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You're working while everyone else is playing.
So that brings up this idea of, let's say, the gentleman restaurateur, someone who's been successful in business, man or woman, and they have this image, oh, I'll sit at the bar and I'll welcome my friends and I'll be, you know, kind of a big deal. Do you see that in your travels?
Oh, without a doubt. People that have capital to invest like to sometimes go on the more glamorous side of things. And it still takes, even with money, it takes more than just that to make a restaurant successful. People with unlimited budgets can build restaurants, but to actually make them work and be successful is another story.
Yeah. How much of restaurant making is having some kind of, you know, special twist? Like you said, you were the first fish restaurant, let's say, in New York City. You know, something that, you know, you could build a franchise on or some special twist. Is that important?
Yes, absolutely. What's happened in the business traditionally over the years is that the manager owner of the restaurant would be the figurehead and walk the room and interact with the guests on a nightly basis. Now it's the personality of the chef that runs a restaurant, especially the personality chefs with a Mario Batali or a Bobby Flay. Those are names that are sought out by real estate people and other entrepreneurs that would like to open up restaurants with their names on it. And those are the personalities now in the restaurant business more than just the owners were years ago.
Right. All right, let's take it from the beginning. You said before that you start with an idea or an inspiration. Kind of take us through the process. Let's say that I do have this idea and it's for XYZ type of food. What's the beginning of this process? I want to go through step by step.
Well, if you have an idea and you have the inspiration to go into the restaurant business, I highly recommend that you perhaps find somebody that has that inspiration as well. An example being a partner. My success grew out of surrounding myself with the most talented people I could find at the time, whether it was waitstaff people or people behind the line in the back of the kitchen, chefs and cooks. I think if you have a bench full of people around you coming into your idea and success, and you can surround yourself with those people, it gives you a better chance of success.
So let's say you've done that. You've got this great idea. You now have to kind of find a partner, surround yourself with talented people, people who know how to train the wait staff, who've run restaurants before. What about, you know, getting the real estate, getting the capital itself? I mean, that seems to me, in some ways, can be very difficult because some of these restaurants, you know, cost a lot to set up.
Right. Well, if you come from nowhere in the restaurant business and you're just looking to open up a restaurant and you're seeking capital, you have maybe you're in money already and there are people available to you.
Mm-hmm.
But suppose you're a person that's been in the restaurant business for many years and you have a resume of titles that you can offer somebody to invest in you as a vehicle for success.
Mm-hmm.
I came to somebody early on in my career that believed in me.
Okay.
I had the desire to go into the restaurant business. I certainly didn't have enough capital to open up our first restaurant. But this person who was a businessman, his name was Arthur Cutler, and he owned Murray's Sturgeon Shop on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. He believed in me. I had been in the restaurant business for years,
mm-hmm.
and I had an idea, and we both enjoyed that idea very much.
Well, he was, you said sturgeon, so he was in the fish business.
Yes, smoked fish and appetizing. Very famous shop on the Upper West Side.
You were opening up your fish restaurant at the time.
Yes, we opened up our first fish restaurant called Doc's Oyster Bar, and that was 89th and Broadway on the west side of the street, right next to Murray's Sturgeon Shop.
Oh, it was right next to it. So he understood the business to a large degree.
Yes.
It wasn't as if he was coming in cold. Okay, let's talk about opening the door. What does it take? You know, you go to a restaurant and the training of the wait staff is all over the map.
Right.
You know, and I guess I eat out a lot, so I kind of notice these things. You notice the patterns of patter with the wait staff, how they tell you about what's on the menu and so on and so forth, how long they leave you to yourself. And, you know, there's always this period of time when it's like just enough, but then it's too long. How do you train a wait staff properly? What does it really take?
Well, you train them to take into consideration all types of circumstances, whether it's a table that's engrossed in conversation and they don't want to be overbearing.
Mm-hmm.
If there's somebody in the party that wants to be recognized as the main person in the party that will be ordering the wine, perhaps.
I see.
But opening up the doors, getting back to the door, mm-hmm. my first impression of a restaurant is the cleanliness of the restaurant.
Okay.
And to talk about opening up the door, I always look at the door itself to see if it's been cleaned.
Mm.
If there's a dirty door, it may be other dirty things in the restaurant. So putting together a restaurant, opening it up, sanitation number one,
mm-hmm.
then you have everything else that goes with that. Your staff, your training of the staff, training them on food, training them on wine, training them on cleanliness, training them on what to wear, perhaps when they're going into their uniforms at work.
Mm-hmm.
I never liked long earrings on women. I didn't like pierced items on anyone's face
mm-hmm.
or earrings on men as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we kept it simple. We kept everything clean. We had our same cadence of servers giving specials at the table the same way all the time.
Yeah.
And people come back for that familiarity.
Yeah, it's consistency, I think, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Consistency is really, really the most important thing.
Interesting. Okay. Well, we're really running out of time here, unfortunately. So what makes people come back the most? Is it the food? Is it the environment? Is it the wait staff? Is it all in one? What is that?
It's a chemical reaction when you walk into a restaurant. And we eat with our eyes. When a plate comes to you and waiter puts it down in front of you, you say to yourself, even subconsciously, oh my, I like this plate. Or, oh, this isn't what I thought it was going to look like.
Yeah.
Or perhaps, wow, I'm really, really impressed with the way this looks and I can't wait to eat it. And that's an impression you want to give people every single time they come into your restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the curtain opens every night, like a Broadway show
right.
is consistent every night. So should your wait staff and your product should be that
mm-hmm.
as well.
Okay. Well, there's an awful lot to talk about here, but we are out of time. My guest is Barry Corwin, a successful restaurateur. And thank you so much for joining us, Barry. Appreciate it.
Steve, thanks so much.
And don't forget to hear this discussion again, to read about it, to weigh in with your opinion. We love your opinions. And also to share it with your friends. And you know we love that too. Don't forget to join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. Joanne Lublin is management news editor for the Wall Street Journal and has written the executive career advice column since 2010. She's used her own extensive career experiences, as well as the compelling stories from 52 corporate female leaders, to write her latest book entitled Earning It, and it's an excellent window into the challenges women executives face in breaking the notorious glass ceiling. Joanne, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
We're not going to be able to get into the entire book. There's a lot of great information in this, but I want to highlight a few ideas that would give our listeners some important insights. The first idea that caught my attention was blooming in place, and you tell the great story of the experiences of Andrea Jung. Would you take us through that, please?
Sure. So Andrea Jung, for those who may not be familiar with her, one day becomes chief executive of the cosmetic giant Avon Products, the very first woman to become CEO of Avon Products. But that was very far in the distant future when in 1984, she's 25 years old. She's making $23,000 a year. She's a swimwear buyer for Bloomingdale's, the glitzy Manhattan department store. And she suddenly gets called to go talk to the chief executive. She was hoping at that point in her early in her career that she would get to run a very trendy division, the ready-to-wear division. And yet, even though her results were great and she felt ready, she had been turned down already for that position. And then she gets called to go talk to the CEO. She wasn't sure why, because she had just been passed over for that ready-to-wear role. And when she talks to him, he offers her what she sees as a less attractive job. He wants her to be merchandise manager for their intimate apparel division, which she felt at that point would have been a really bad move for her. Selling underwear in the 1980s was a very low priority for Bloomingdale's.
That was well before Victoria's Secret and all of that.
You got it. And not only that, this was a department which at Bloomingdale's had been run by the same man for 30 years. Mm-hmm. He and his buyers, who were all guys, worked in a windowless office in the sub-sub-basement. Mm-hmm. The subway was running nearby.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he asked her to take the job. She asks for a day or two to decide because she doesn't see this as really being a good move for her. But the CEO says, you could transform lingerie into an exciting department and create kind of a new vision, you know, for a department that had always been kind of the backwater. And she says later in hindsight that if she hadn't accepted his offer, she said, I wouldn't have learned what it's like to dive into something where at first you feel like you're over your head. And when you take that kind of dive, it tests your ability to become a leader.
Mm-hmm.
And when she gets on her way to take the job the very first day down there in the sub-basement, she remembers that she had seen a poster of a potted plant on the wall of the HR office, of the human resource office. And the poster said, bloom where you're planted.
Mm-hmm.
And it suddenly occurs to her that maybe if you take a job that is not the ideal job that you see as a detour, you could perhaps make something of it because you have the potential for turning essentially what wasn't gold into gold. And exactly what she did. Even though these people were all men, they were older than her, she takes the bull by the horns and she makes a whole bunch of bold changes. She does things like adding bright colored bras and panties mm-hmm. to what had always been white and beige underwear.
Mm-hmm.
And these new items sell out. And of course, the department did fabulously well during the 2 years that she's in that role. And she says to me, for the book, it was a career-defining moment. And then she later joins Avon and finds herself in similar kinds of roles where she has to bloom where she's planted, but she proves herself.
You know, there are two ironies that stand out to me. First irony is that there were men that were running the women's lingerie department,
yes.
Number one. And number two, that she's the first woman to take over Avon, which is
exactly. Another
irony there.
And that doesn't happen until 1999, so
yeah. We're
not talking about the dark ages here.
Right,
we're talking
right. About
18 years ago.
But you also mentioned a good point about this idea about being in over your head. You know, people starting out on new jobs, they're all in over their heads because they don't have
right. The
work experience And so there's this phrase that I use a lot, you know, fake it to make it.
Right.
And I wonder what you thought about this idea of, you know, getting into a job where you probably have the talent, but you don't yet have the knowledge or the skills.
Correct. And it's often what has derailed women, I think, in advancing to the level that they want to. Men are often promoted, studies have shown, based on their potential to do a new job. Women are promoted on what they've already achieved, because it goes back to some long-held stereotypes of what we expect how women and men will operate in leadership roles. And I think a very strong theme in the book is this notion of taking calculated risks.
Yeah.
In Andrea's case, the calculated risk was by accepting a promotion for a less than desirable assignment that perhaps she could prove that she had the right stuff to move up into higher level jobs.
Well, there's a higher level risk that you talk about in the book called, you know, the Mission Impossible assignment.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that a little bit.
Well, the Mission Impossible assignment is not what Andrea took on. The
right.
Mission Impossible assignment is the role that lots of people have been sounded out about and nobody wants to do, men and women alike. So you have to be willing to take on Mission Impossible assignments where you think you have a reasonable chance of being successful.
Mm-hmm.
You should not be taking Mission Impossible assignments just for the purpose of proving yourself, because you may end up stumbling.
Yeah.
But you have to, you know, figure out whether there is a boss who's going to have your back. You have to figure out if you have a fallback position if it doesn't work out.
Right.
The greatest example of that was Ellen Coleman, who later becomes the CEO of DuPont. And when she's asked to start a totally new business for DuPont in safety consulting, it is considered so risky that not a single colleague calls her or sends her an email of congratulations when she takes that role. But she protects herself against the possibility of failure in this Mission Impossible assignment by getting a get-out-of-jail-free card from the CEO. And he tells her, if after 6 months this is a complete disaster, I will give you a lateral move to something comparable to what you gave up to take on this role.
Good. Quid pro quo for her. So it's high risk, basically, but high reward, but failure can kill a career, or at least create a tremendous setback.
The whole point of the book is that setbacks shouldn't be career killers. Setbacks should be lessons in which you try and figure out what went wrong, what should you do differently, and for the next situation like that that may come up, you don't just have plan A and plan B. Ellen Coleman talks about this in the book as well. You have to have plan C, as she discovered when she had a childcare crisis on a Sunday night.
Tell us about that.
Well, in this particular situation, she had three young children. They were away on a family vacation, and as they were about to board their flight to come back to Delaware from Missouri, she learns that their pregnant nanny has gone into premature labor with twins. It's 2 weeks before the start of the school year, and she has not yet lined up alternate childcare because, you know, the nanny's giving birth so early. And so she says to me in the book, I had nobody to watch the kids. 18 hours later, was I going to leave these children home alone? And so at the airport, she starts calling up everyone she could think of to see who could step in. The problem was that students who were in college had already gone back to school. She luckily finds one whose college year has not started because she's on a quarter system. But she said that after that nerve-wracking predicament, she always made sure that she had three backup plans, A, B, and C, for unforeseen child care needs. And frankly, in making career moves, I think you also should have plan A, B, and C if it doesn't work out, or if it does work out. You need to think about those alternatives too.
Yeah. I think it also highlights the additional challenges many women face juggling, you know, a family and career and the kind of responsibilities that most women have to do both.
Exactly.
I want to talk about pay a little bit because you address that in the book. In the book, you suggest using what you call the velvet glove and other tactics, and you're really discussing in the book equal pay, not necessarily just going for a raise, but to get equal pay. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, the problem is that the gender pay gap continues and will be with us probably for decades to come. And lots of people say to me, you know, why do companies not pay women the, you know, what they pay men? Well, part of the reason is that women don't raise their hand and say, this is what I'm worth, this is what other people at this job are making. And this has got to be an equal responsibility. There was a survey that Glamour magazine did a couple of years ago in which only 39% of women said they had asked for a higher salary when they started a new job. Yet 54% of the men did. Mm-hmm. And among those who were already working, 43% of the women said they had ever in their life asked for a raise, and 54% of the men. Mm-hmm. So my philosophy in that chapter, The Pain of the Pay Pinch, is if you don't ask, you don't get.
My guest, Joanne Lublin, management news editor for The Wall Street Journal, and her book is Earning It. As I said before, it's an excellent window into the challenges women executives face in breaking the glass ceiling, and also just as a basic career guide and idea of how other successful women have met their challenges. Joanne, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Steve.
My pleasure. To hear this interview again, don't forget to join us at stevepomerantz.com and sign up for our weekly update, where you will get a list of all of the topics that we're discussing every single week. And you can pick and choose. You can listen to a segment that particularly matches what you're looking to hear, or you can also read it as we provide summaries, and we also provide transcriptions as well.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So you've heard the term inverted yield curve.
Yeah, I sure have.
And you may have heard the term negative interest rates.
Yeah.
Negative interest rate mortgages. And people ask me, Steve, what the heck is that?
Yes, Steve, please explain.
Now, I know.
Because I've never actually seen it.
Well, you know, starting with negative interest rates, I understand that there was a very brief period of time during the depths of the 1930s.
That's why I didn't see it.
Depression, where rates went negative. But this is something that's actually very common now in the developed countries, in Europe especially. What we're basically seeing, actually $15 trillion worth of bonds,
right,
are now sport negative interest rates. Now, what is the negative interest rate? So we all know that if we put our money in a bank or we buy a CD,
right,
that in effect we're lending money to the bank and they're paying us, let's say, 2% for a year.
Right.
That's a positive interest rate. Now, when you lend money, you're taking a risk, and you're supposed to be paid according to the level of that risk. So when you have a CD, there's really no risk. It's backed by the U.S. government, so the rates are very low. If you're lending to a kind of a, you know, a middle-sized company or a small company or a startup, you know, you'd expect to earn a higher rate of interest because you have more of a risk of losing your money, and
sure,
you need to be compensated for it. That's normal.
Right.
What's not normal is if you borrow money.
Okay. So you borrow
instead
money.
Instead of paying interest rate, you are actually receiving money back that comes back to you in the terms of reducing your debt outstanding.
Okay, that just makes perfect sense.
Okay. So there are mortgages in Denmark, right, where you, quote, borrow the money to buy your house, but instead of paying, you know, 5% or 3% in addition to your principal every month, you pay your principal, and the bank credits you,
wow,
X number of dollars to reduce the amount of the outstanding principal.
I kind of like that. Can I move to Denmark?
I think.
Oh, well, wait, I forgot about the taxes. What is it, 90% yeah, of your taxes goes to the government?
Well, that is true. That is another thing. I was trying to look, and I Googled this, but of course I know it's not possible. Can a U.S. citizen borrow money out of Denmark? I mean, that makes perfect,
yeah,
sense. Of course, there's a thing about the currency fluctuation. Someone's going to have to protect themselves.
There's a middleman in there too.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not going to happen. But the big talk right now is the question of whether the U.S. is in fact going to go down this path of negative interest rates, because we have seen now interest rates at incredibly low ebb.
Sure, sure.
I mean, if you were to buy a 10-year treasury bond, so that means you're lending the government money for 10 years, you don't get your principal back for 10 years,
right?
It's less than 2%.
Wow.
You know, and it's like, is that really possible? Would I really want to only earn 2% for the next 10 years? So 2% doesn't seem that far away from a negative.
No, rate, it doesn't.
Especially if there's outside pressures from other important economies in the world. So when you get, so you have these negative interest rates, also what is happening that is unusual and somewhat troubling to many is this thing called the inverted yield curve.
Right.
Any idea what that is?
You know, I studied it when I studied my MBA in accounting, so I'm familiar with it, but you know what? I've never actually even seen it, so.
Okay, it's an esoteric concept.
Right.
So when you look at the treasury market, you're looking at treasury bills, which are maturities of 1 year or less. You're looking at notes, which are like 1 to 10 years, and then you're looking at bonds, which are 10 years or more. So there's different maturities.
Right.
And when you plot this out, under normal times, the shorter maturity should have a lower yield.
Lower yield, yep.
Intermediate, a higher, and then long-term, higher. So if you plotted that out on a graph, you'd have a curve that would slope from the left, bottom left, up to the right.
Correct,
okay?
Yep.
Well, what's happened is that the Fed raised interest rates, but stopped. And because of all this worry about what's going on in the world, and the fact that there's an awful lot of money out there washing around and floating around and looking for a place to land, and if that money doesn't want to take risk, it goes to treasuries. That pushes down the treasury yields.
Okay.
Now the treasury yield of the 10-year bond is lower than the 2-year.
Right.
Okay. So now instead of the curve going from the bottom left up to the right, it actually is higher up on the left and comes down as you go out the maturity scale, inverted.
Right.
Now, why do we care? We care because in times past, whenever you saw an inverted yield curve, that was a signal, usually about 20 months later, that the economy would go into recession because it represented what is considered tight money. The Fed is tightening, is lowering the money supply because it's afraid of a booming economy and high inflation, accelerating inflation. We're not seeing any of that now.
Right, right.
Inflation's very tame. The economy is doing extremely well, but I wouldn't say it's getting ahead of itself. It's crazy, crazy expanding and all of that. It's just healthy. So I personally think it's not that much of a big deal in the sense that it's not because the Fed is pushing up interest rates to try to slow the economy down. I think it's the fact that you've got all this money that's chasing safety in the longer end of the market, pushing down the yields there. So it's this anomaly that doesn't really feel like it's necessarily going to lead to recession later down the road.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Now I got a great education.
I'm exhausted.
Inverted yields.
Now getting back to real estate.
Oh, and now real estate. No, it's important. That's
recessions don't matter that much in real estate.
Yeah,
though.
You know, we were talking about it off air. I've been doing this for 30 years, and I started in 89. We were in a recession, and then I saw maybe a couple little ones. They were quick, short, swift, and we were in and out of them. So I didn't really feel them in the real estate world.
Yeah.
You know, my personal life maybe, but not with the sales.
I think the average recession lasts about 14 months. Maybe the most is like 20 months.
So it's nothing to get.
But I think real estate is a different asset class. I mean, people live in their homes.
Right.
And yes, I think real estate is going to get soft if people really start losing their jobs, depending on how deep the recession is.
That turns into a.
That's where it starts to hurt.
A crash.
2008 was a crash because it was such a devastation. The economy was so devastated by all the mortgages that blew up and all of that.
And we're not going to see that. That's not what's going on
here.
It's just
a
typical cyclical.
That's right. Very good.
Turn down.
My guest, as always, is Terry Story, a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. And she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, PomeranZ.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Cass Sunstein is the founder and director of the program on behavioral economics and public policy at Harvard. Now, this is my first time meeting him, but his many books include one of my favorites, the bestseller Nudge, written with Richard Thaler, whom I've heard speak about the book in Chicago a few years ago. Hi, Cass. It's a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for coming.
Hi, Steve. Great to be on.
So, Cass, sit back for a second and allow me to set the scene. Imagine the most powerful country in the world and a set of smaller countries unified in the effort to bring peace and prosperity to the world have been challenged by rebellious forces and extremists. And in the meantime, within these same countries, forces of change are moving toward a direction of isolation and division. What do you think I'm describing? Is this Brexit, or is this a description of your new book, The World According to Star Wars?
Well, it's recognizably connected with Star Wars. How this involves developments in Europe is a more complicated question. So my initial answer is, sounds like Star Wars, the prequels.
Okay. Well, you know, I do think that there are some analogies to your book and to what's going on today. But first of all, let me just ask you, you write so many serious books. What prompted you to write a book relating to Star Wars themes?
It was basically my little boy, now 7 years old, who at age five got improbably obsessed with the Star Wars movies for at least 6 weeks. And when he was focused on the Star Wars movies, I got really curious about why these movies became the defining saga of our time. Why did they earn $30 billion? Why are children all over the world really interested in Star Wars? And also I got keenly interested in how George Lucas, the kind of mastermind of the saga, how did he come up with this stuff? And it turns out that there are a ton of surprises and false starts and unanticipated bursts of imagination, both in the success of Star Wars, which was not expected, and in the genesis of Star Wars. So when I saw all that, it connected with things in business, as your opening question suggests, in politics, definitely in law, in economic developments. That seemed to fall into place. I was hooked.
Well, the saga of Star Wars was very much based or helped with Joseph Campbell's 1949 book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And Joseph Campbell was an important influence on Lucas. So I'd like you to take a moment to describe George Lucas's universe.
Well, I think you've got the kind of sun, so to speak, of the S-U-N of Lucas's universe, which is the monomyth, which is an idea that many religions and cultures have, as cultural myths, have a tale of a hero's journey, where there's someone who is kind of isolated with a family and at home, who's called to some very big adventure, who initially declines, who then says yes, who finds a mentor, who is challenged and maybe whose life is at risk, who surmounts the challenge, who lives, and then eventually returns home, at least in some way. And that monomyth, which you can see in Christianity and Judaism and Islam in various forms, is the kind of core of the tale of Star Wars. So George Lucas told that tale both about Luke and about Anakin Skywalker, and in some ways about Leia Skywalker also, the heroine's journey. And that's kind of what Lucas was about, but he gave it some very original twists having to do with self-government and freedom in that sense, and also freedom of choice at the individual level.
Right. I want to get into that, particularly in today's world. So these themes I guess him tapping into this age-old theme is one of the great reasons for the success. But when you think about Star Wars and you think about the Empire and you think about the rebels and, you know, one side's good is another side's evil and vice versa, it's a little bit more complicated than just purely good and evil. But talking about the shifting that's going on in American society today, now we're not really talking about good or evil, but we're talking about the status quo being upset by, in a sense, rebellious forces. Take us through some of the parallels between Star Wars and what's going on in American society today.
Well, there's a tale in Star Wars about an authoritarian government that gets dismantled by freedom-loving rebels. There's also a tale in Star Wars about a republic that is not functioning so great, that gets undermined from within by authoritarian forces. And I think the first tale of the triumph of republics is best understood as parallel to the American Revolution. I don't think that's what Lucas had in mind, but I think that's the closest parallel.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the disintegration of a self-governing society and its kind of usurpation by an authoritarian government, the best parallel is Nazi Germany, and that George Lucas did have in mind, at least as one of the historical models. So the United States now is, in my view, an extremely well-functioning republic for all of its challenges by historical standards. It's stable, robust, and massively successful, notwithstanding the economic and, let's call them, old-style Republican challenges that is making democracy work well. So I wouldn't say that we're at risk of an Emperor Palpatine, and I wouldn't say that we are now an empire that's being rebelled against by people who don't like it.
So you don't see us at that point then, where there's an analogy with these. But there is a force of change taking place in American society where the status quo, I think in some way, seems to have become very solidified and maybe to a degree inflexible. And many individuals seem to be unhappy with how the economy is treating them. And therefore, you're starting to see a change take place. Is this just imagined or do you see this as something that's actually happening?
You raise a great point. So the forces of change have two faces right now. And one is Donald Trump and the other is Bernie Sanders. And they're very, very different. So in terms of your point, you know, to kind of underline where I think you're onto something, is that in any period in which a nation's legislative branch is paralyzed by an inability to reach a consensus, there is an attraction to many people in the idea of a strong man who will set things right.
Yeah.
Now, the strong man could be a woman, but in our case, I think some of Trump's appeal, whether you like him or not, is that he is seen as possibly, you know, steering things on a course, at least, when previously we've been kind of buffeted about on the ocean. And that you can see in Europe now, and it's certainly something that the Star Wars saga depicts in a very negative sense. I'm not a Trump supporter by any means, so I don't think that this is a good model for the United States, but there's no question that there is appeal, and there's a real parallel there with a psychological and political depiction in Star Wars that we are seeing. Now, the Bernie Sanders idea isn't about a strong man. It's about unjust inequality. And what Sanders is depicting is not a paralyzed legislature so much as a government which is, in his view, run by a self-interested elite, namely wealthy people and banks. Now, I'd say two things about that. First, and less important, I just don't share that view, though, you know, I admire Sanders' moral commitment. I don't think he has America right. But much more important for purposes of the present discussion, that particular dynamic is not the dynamic depicted in Star Wars. The mm-hmm. Star Wars does depict a different kind of rebellion. What Star Wars depicts is something like the appeal and false authority of the strong man.
My guest is Cass Sunstein. He's the founder and director of the program on behavioral economics and public policy at Harvard. And he has co-written the book Nudge with Richard Thaler, a very well-regarded book. And his new book is The World According to Star Wars and That Hero's Journey and this understanding of how this myth plays out generation after generation, or really civilization after civilization. We're trying to get some context here. Cass, you specialize in behavioral economics, and you have written that you've shown that if people describe options in a certain way, you can get people to do and even see what you want. You get a chance to lead them, I guess, in a positive sense, and perhaps manipulate them in a negative sense. And you don't have to really be a futurist to see this. It's kind of a common human condition. Can you describe that to us a little bit?
Okay, so the way I'd phrase it is that human beings are not computers, they are not algorithms, that we are subject to predictable biases, that how problems are described and what the starting point is can often influence outcomes. So if you're defaulted into a system where you have a double-sided printer, you're going to be saving a lot of paper. If you're defaulted into a single-sided printer, you're going to be using a lot of paper. If you're defaulted into a savings plan of a certain kind, chances are you're going to stick with it. Most people do. If you have to sign up, the likelihood is that at least a significant number of people won't. People's risk judgments are often a product of what readily comes to mind. So if you hear about people getting Ebola, you might be really scared, even if the statistical risk is really low. So we have about 40 years now of really terrific research on how people's thinking departs from standard rational models. And this is true, you know, basically of all of us if we're human. Now, if you have a GPS, it can counteract some of your biases by just telling you this is the right direction to go if you want to get to your preferred destination fast. If you have a problem described as one in which if you use an energy conservation approach, you'll save $100 a year, that tends to be less effective than if you don't use it, you'll lose $100 a year. So people are very unhappy with the idea of losses, and just describing something as a loss can trigger their attention. So what we're dealing here now in response to your question is first, how people are not perfectly rational. They're not irrational, but they are not perfectly rational. And second, how either a public-spirited or a self-interested outsider or a family member can oppress people in the directions that may be in the interest of the person or may be in the interest of the person who's doing the nudging, let's say.
So you may have two people with the same exact ideas, and one of them perhaps is using fear as a mode for communication. And since a human being is wired to react more to fear than to pleasure, that person may be able to manipulate us more or have more power over us.
Completely. So if people are scared of, let's say, losing money in the stock market, that can really get them to put the money under their pillow. Whereas if they're hopeful of making money in the stock market, that's good, but it's less good than the fear of losing money is bad for most people. So losses, I'd say, are very stirring to the human brain, more so than gains are stirring to the human brain. This is actually true not just of human beings, it's true of a wide range of mammals. And there may be an evolutionary reason for this, that losses can get us going. And it is true that people can be manipulated in this way, and politicians sometimes do that. And they can also be helped in this way by people who are, you know, just trying to help people make wiser choices.
Very interesting. You know, you mentioned earlier that the Star Wars saga has some elements to it that inform us about how the law works. And recently we've seen some landmark decisions from the Supreme Court. And I was wondering where the analogy is with Star Wars and how the Supreme Court makes decisions.
Yes, great. So in Star Wars, there are episodes. And each episode has to be faithful to the one that came before, in the sense that it can't ignore it and just conclude that what happened there was somebody's dream. It has to respect it, but it also has to, and they're talking about Star Wars now, make the unfolding narrative good rather than idiotic or farcical. So that's the goal. in creation of new episodes of Star Wars. When it works, the goal is fulfilled. The Supreme Court is doing something actually quite analogous. So if the court is deciding an issue involving affirmative action or the power of the president or abortion, it basically has to respect the prior episodes. In extraordinary circumstances, you can overrule them, but those are really extraordinary. It has to respect them, but also make what the justices think is good sense out of them. And the contest within the court and the country really is often, has the court respected prior episodes, and has it made sense rather than nonsense out of them? So American law actually has I am your father moments, so to speak, as in The Empire Strikes Back, where the law takes a shift that makes you see everything in a new light. And when it's working well, people have an immediate reaction of, you're kidding, or, oh my God, but quickly followed by a reaction of course, that's right. And that's what happened with eliminating school segregation, though it wasn't universal, that's right. It took a few decades. With same-sex marriage, I think we're seeing something pretty similar.
The book, The World According to Star Wars, the author Cass Sunstein, founder and director of the Program on Behavioral Economics and Public Policy at Harvard, and also co-author of the bestseller Nudge with Richard Thaler. Cass, so interesting. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. A great pleasure. Really enjoyed it. Thanks, Steve.
I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Melzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by The Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which The Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.